Hi, this is Robert Scott Bell filling in for Ty Bollinger here with the truth about vaccines. There are a lot of places that he can be, but not all at the same time. So we're going to continue on with some fascinating interviews here that'll help us understand not only the truth about vaccines, but the options that you have to undo the damage or injury from it, and also the fact that maybe the whole concept of vaccination at the starting point may not be a good one, and we might need to look completely differently back to our history to understand what is a strong child, what is a strong adult, and how do we develop through those childhood infections and how they may be beneficial for us rather than detrimental and scary. And right now we've got Dr. Deborah Gambrell from the San Francisco Bay Area, practicing physician, and she was here speaking at the Homeoprophylaxis Conference, a worldwide choice, and presented on some things that I've been involved in this a long time. I hadn't heard communicated in the way you did. Deborah, welcome.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
So what is it that you do in your San Francisco Bay Area clinic as a physician?
Well, I have two practices. I'm a pediatric anesthesiologist, and I also do immune recovery work with my osteopathic practice. Both are strictly pediatric.
Okay, so working with children, obviously, mm-hmm. the pediatric community, and that's a real key here, because observationally, as a homeopath and other doctors we've talked to have said, you know, the healthiest children we see are the ones that are not vaccinated or the least vaccinated. I wonder if you've had a similar experience.
Yeah, you know, working in the operating room, I'll have children that look healthy on paper and can have two very different responses. And over a few years, watching these children go to sleep under anesthesia, I saw that the children that weren't vaccinated or the mm-hmm. ones that were delayed later did better under anesthesia. And by mm-hmm. better, I mean they had a better vagal response.
Vagal response. That's something not a lot of people have heard about. What is a vagal response?
So what that is when you have a stimulation within the body, your heart rate can go down and then it recovers and goes back up. That's normal. That's what you want. A healthy child will have that response mm-hmm. When you are stimulating certain areas of the body, whether it's the trachea or the stomach or the eyes, you want that vagal response. Now what I've seen is children that are heavily vaccinated from birth, they don't have that vagal response. It's just a lack of that heart rate variability that we see even in babies in utero. That's what we're looking for. That beat-to-beat heart variability is important uh-huh. and a sign of health.
So Dr. Gambrell, you're saying that if children are coming to you and they're having a surgical procedure that requires some form of anesthesia, mm-hmm. That the response of those children is different than someone who hasn't been vaccinated. Again, that's something I don't think I had ever heard.
Yeah.
So it's a stunning observation.
Yeah, it's interesting. We have a high amount of unvaccinated children in Northern California, and I don't think I would have seen that had I been practicing in an urban area.
Mm-hmm. Now, when we look at the interesting concept of vaccination that says, you know, it's better to prevent diseases by artificially stimulating an antibody, would you agree that these childhood diseases need to be prevented at all costs?
Well, what I'm seeing is what I call a fever drought. So children today need to be getting fevers. All children historically need to have fevers every 6 to 12 months as they're developing. These are fevers that bring them into their body. These are fevers that clear the gut from anything, viral proteins that aren't digested, food proteins that aren't digested. So we expect that children should have roseola at 6 months, chickenpox between 12 and 18 months, measles, mumps, rubella. These are the normal things that our body has evolutionarily been designed to take in to process anything that's undigested. Mm-hmm. Right now, like I said, we're in a fever drought, so we're lucky if a child gets a fever of 102 or higher. You know, some children still get roseola, some children still get maybe hand, foot, and mouth, which is relatively new. But we're not seeing enough fevers. And so without these gut reset fevers, we're seeing increase in asthma, ADHD, sensory disorder. The children are not in their body. You can see this when you go out in the grocery store. You can see children that are not able to walk down the grocery aisle and be aware of where they are in space. One out of two children is what I see are affected.
And some of these children are not being diagnosed necessarily into the autism spectrum, but you're seeing this disconnect with their body. They're like not in their body.
They're not in their body. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now you said something very interesting here in that last grouping of sentences. The gut fever reset. Is that the way to say it? Or gut reset fever?
Yeah, gut fever reset. It's okay. You know, something, it's a term that I coined, and that is the clearance of whatever has been accumulating in the gut. over time that usually gets cleared every 6 to 12 months with a fever. And what that looks like clinically or developmentally, when a child has a nice high fever and it does affect the gut and clear it, you see a developmental leap. So maybe a child that couldn't ride a bike can now ride a bike. A child that couldn't skip can now skip. And this is commonly seen and is appreciated in developmental pediatrics. Without these fevers, without these gut resets, we're not seeing these developmental leaps.
Our culture in the West has been told that fevers are dangerous, they're scary, you want to reduce them at all costs, and the cost may be the price of their health in the future.
Yeah, we've been losing our heat for three generations now. You know, we know that in 1922, Sears Roebuck had their first razor for women. That was the year that they had the sleeveless dresses for women. The clothes became less natural fibers, less wool, cotton, linen, and now they're replaced with polyester and synthetics. In the 40s and 50s, we started with the antibiotics. 1959, Tylenol was introduced, and it was heavily pushed as a replacement for aspirin. I grew up on Tylenol. Every time I had a sniffle, I had Tylenol. And the 80s, 90s, we started with the increasing vaccination. So for three generations, we're seeing children are losing their sense of heat. And what we're seeing is each generation goes by, we're seeing an increased amount of dysfunctions that I say are all related to lack of heat. And so that's everything from stillbirths to SIDS to autism to ADHD, asthma. These are all diseases from lack of heat.
Okay, in Chinese medicine, they talk about heat. When you talk about heat, I sort of understand it in terms of the fear of fever, the reduction of any kind of elevation of temperature, which is designed, I believe, by God for the immune system to overcome certain things, but also seemingly developmentally. Mm-hmm. Like when we have these childhood eruptive diseases, for instance, the measles, how it seems to be preventing future cancers even.
Yeah. There's some data with mumps and cancer and chickenpox and brain cancer. There's certainly data out there that speak to just that. There's also a bunch of data right now in the literature about pregnant women that use acetaminophen while they are pregnant or shortly after, their children do have increased asthma, ADHD, behavioral disorders, sensory disorders. Yeah. This is not unknown. And also giving asthma treatments are also fueling that.
And that's become the norm, chronic disease in children.
Yeah, it sure is. I have just a few weeks ago, I had a child that I saw, a one-year-old child, had a diagnosis of asthma, and they were already written three prescription refills for their inhaler. The child's only been alive for 12 months, so the expectation is this child's not going to get better. The expectation is this is a sick child, this child will always be sick.
So where is the discussion within the medical community as to whether it's even advisable and a good idea to suppress these childhood diseases?
You know, I'm seeing a little bit of a trend of reversal. Within the last 5 years, I know within the anesthesia world, we have decreased the amount of Tylenol and the incidence of where we're going to use it right away. Mm-hmm. So maybe they might hold off a little bit. We've seen that pediatricians now, the standard of care is to not give pre-dosing Tylenol for vaccinations. Now, there are still a lot of pediatricians that are recommending that, but the standard of care, based on studies, is to not give Tylenol before or after a vaccine, because that is proven scientifically, NIH study, to increase the risk of autism.
Now, your experience as a practicing physician also now encompasses what we're here to talk about, homeopathy, a little bit of homeoprophylaxis. Have you seen evidence of utilizing homeopathy in place of, for instance, the idea of Tylenol to reduce a fever? You know, if somebody is scared of a high fever, is there a way to manage it without suppressing it and squashing that heat that you feel and have seen is so important?
Yeah, I work really closely with my families. At my patients, fever is an emergency. That is when they call me. They have my cell phone number, they call me right away. As soon as their child gets their first fever, and I walk them through a homeopathic treatment of their fever so that we can take the fever from their head. Children are complaining of headaches now with fevers, which is unusual. This is a new clinical presentation of fevers, and we are trying to get the fever down into their metabolic system. And so we work with the family, you know, to put the Tylenol on the shelf, try this homeopathic. I watch the child very closely. If there's any sign that there's any issue, you know, of course that child's going to get advanced medical care. But working very closely with this family so that they can develop an intuition and a trust in their ability to treat their child, mm-hmm. I think is really important.
Another aspect that we're becoming aware of, the danger of vaccines, of course, mercury has been now sort of commonly known as a toxic metal, right? Mm-hmm. But aluminum is a newer thing that they've added in as an adjuvant, and not as much study has been done. You have looked at this issue and see it relates to this heat-cold, how you describe it.
It sure does. Dr. Christopher Exley, who's been studying aluminum for over 30 years, he's a specialist in the ecotoxicity of aluminum, has shown that aluminum can lead to food sensitivities. So we're now reacting to foods that we wouldn't normally be reacting to. There are mouse studies that show this. Dr. Shaw has a study that shows you inject a mouse with aluminum, and now they can't tolerate that next bite of food that they eat. They develop IgG antibodies to it. We also know Dr. Schoenfeld has been studying autoimmune disease. He's in Tel Aviv. He's published over 1,600 papers. He's been cited over 20,000 times on PubMed. He's written books. He wrote the book, Vaccines and Autoimmunity, talking specifically about aluminum and how it cools the body, meaning there's increased food sensitivity, there's increased autoimmune disease. So we're talking multiple sclerosis, lupus, rheumatoid arthritis, Alzheimer's. All of these things are directly related to the aluminum that's being injected.
Absolutely fascinating what is being uncovered. And you spend the time to study what's being put out there in the peer-reviewed literature, and then you also have the clinical knowledge to apply it or observe it and validate it in this way.
Yeah, I think it's important to see what we're seeing, to actually look at the patient and change our mind when new information comes in. You know, we had an idea of what vaccines were over the last few decades. We have an idea. But in the last year, we found out that aluminum is neurotoxic, it's got these autoimmune issues. We found out that there's glyphosates in the vaccine. Dr. Anthony Samsel and Stephanie Seneff and MIT just discovered that. We're finding out all this new information. So I think any good scientist should take this new information and look at the picture again. We do that with anesthesia. We previously weren't testing our anesthetics on children under 2 because there's an FDA issue with trying to get children into studies, and that's understandable. But then when we saw that there was a correlation that children were getting injured under age 2, they were looking at when children got anesthesia for ear tube placement, that they were having memory problems years later. So they were able to tease that out. There's a program called Smart Tots with anesthesia. They were able to tease that out with anesthesia. I think we should do the same thing with vaccines. Now that we're coming with new data, new information about what vaccines are or aren't doing, I think we should take a critical look scientifically and what is happening. I think it's an important question.
Dr. Gambrill, you're not only a doctor, but you're a mother. And if you speak, put on your mother hat for a moment, and you speak to other parents. Off the record, you're not a doctor at the moment. And how do you communicate what you've observed from one mom to another?
I just tell them to watch their child. Before and after a vaccine, take a picture. Take a picture of the child's face. Take a picture of all the rashes. Watch your child closely. Stay close to your child when they're sick. Don't push the child back into school right away. You know, trying to rewrite the paradigm of what it is. You know, as mothers, we were expected to do it all. We're expected to work, we're expected to raise the kid, to clean the house, to do everything. I think that it is vital that the mothers take an active role. When their kid gets sick, have somebody else cook dinner, have somebody else take a day off work and be with your child. It is vitally important. And that's another big source of warmth, is directly from the mother to be able to warm the child's environment, to help the child digest the things that they cannot otherwise digest.
Yeah, we've lost generations now of tribal knowledge of these things, the fever, the importance of fever, the transition through childhood through these diseases that really don't largely kill anyone that's basically healthy, that has basic nutrition, sanitation, hygiene. We see in the West these improvements that happen over the 20th century. Mm-hmm. How do we regain that tribal knowledge? Because so few people even know the things you're talking about, even not only from the scientific way, but from the mom way.
Yeah, I would say it's just staying connected. There's a bunch of mom groups. There's Facebook. There's a lot of vaccine. There's a lot of vaccine awareness groups. You know, it's about information. It's about vaccine information, and I think that's the way we go. You know, what is truly happening? How can we manage disease? I think these groups are vitally important. A source I always recommend to my patients is a book called Vaccine Primer by Elliot Freed. It's a book that explains where vaccines came from, the history of vaccines, and the importance of the immune system, and that community. There's a community piece in there and how to achieve that piece.
Well, Dr. Gambrill, I certainly appreciate your scientific integrity, your willingness to communicate in a clear fashion on a very important series of issues here, not only the issues of the dangers of vaccines, but also how to observe and care for the children that may need to go through these things in a healthier way and what to do about it.
Yeah, thank you.